This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
Hey, 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 what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Yes, I'm Michael Steele, and it is such a treat to have you pop in for the conversation that we're about to have. Certainly, you can download this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn. We like it when you do that. It makes me feel good. I sleep easier at night, so help a brother out, all right? So go to those locations, wherever you get your podcasts on, and do the download thing. Certainly, you can follow me on Twitter, at Michael Steele. We'd love to get your thoughts on the tweet from time to time. So tonight, today, tomorrow, where are we? Well, we're in Mueller space, and the world of anticipation is out there for the dropping of the Mueller report. Certainly, that's something we're going to get into. And also sort of talk about what happened in Paris with the fires at Notre Dame Cathedral. And to help us sort of sort through all of that is this young blood who's out there who's making some serious waves. Stephen Olakara is the founder and president of Millennial Action Project, the largest, now get this folks, the largest nonpartisan organization of young lawmakers in not just the states, but the United States. Welcome, Stephen, to the Michael Steele Podcast. Great to have you, man.
Thanks for having me, Michael. Appreciate it.
So you're out there doing that good millennial work, and I've always had a special place in my heart for millennials, having raised two of them, and sort of a good appreciation of the enormous potential of this generation of young men and women who come at culture, society, politics from a very different perspective. What is the Millennial Action Project about? How does it work? Who's involved? The kind of candidates and young lawmakers you're supporting? Give us the lowdown on what you're doing, man.
Sure. Well, we started Millennial Action Project back in 2013, which, as many of your viewers might remember, was the year of the last-to-last government shutdown. And that was the time when congressional approval ratings went down to 9%. And we saw that Congress was, in fact, less popular than headlights and used car salesmen and all kinds of things, right?
All those comfort creatures, you know.
Right. Exactly. And so my co-founding team and I, we looked at this situation, and we believe there two powerful forces shaping the future of American politics. One is the worsening polarization, which is either, in my view, explicitly or implicitly embedded into virtually every major headline today.
Yeah.
And studies on polarization show that they're at the highest levels between the two parties since the Civil War. So that's pretty serious stuff. And the second big force we saw is the rising millennial generation. Now, back in 2013, there were only a handful of millennials in Congress.
Right.
And to be honest, when I talked about millennials back then, most people would say, so are you hoping to work with interns, or what's your focus here?
Right.
You know?
Right.
And,
yeah. And so somebody catch coffee, right? That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Yeah. You know, we can get you coffee and hopefully we can make some good laws too.
Right.
You know, the first, we saw this amazing generational opportunity, the first of the millennial cohort running for office and maturing as voters. And the question really becomes, how is this next generation going to govern our country? We are being faced with a number of generational threats, whether it's the national debt or climate change. But also, young people today have some of the highest levels of unemployment and underemployment. We're being hit with the student debt crisis. So many in our generation have served abroad. And so there's some big, big challenges. And our theory of change is what we call generational replenishment, which is a nice way of saying that, the biggest opportunity we have to shape a new set of norms where maybe constructive cooperation is more prevalent than constant tribal conflict. The greatest promise we have is in building young leaders. And actually, in my prior gigs, I've done a lot of youth development work, training young leaders in my hometown of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So I've seen the power of young people to transform things. And so that became part of the theory of change. And so we started organizing these young lawmakers as they enter Congress and help them build relationships, help them govern, and then help amplify their impact to a national audience. So as an example, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say, as an example, in the last Congress, we started the nation's first ever bipartisan caucus for young members, for millennials. And to be honest, we were looking around like, really? There's no caucus for youth essentially in Congress, and so we formed it. And last Congress we had people like Congresswoman Kyrsten Sinema, who's now in the U.S. Senate,
right.
former Congressman Carlos Curbelo, Congressman Mike Gallagher, and Congressman Stephanie Murphy, Congressman Joe Kennedy. Virtually every millennial in Congress, Democrats and Republicans, are part of it. But what's also exciting, Michael, is that we're engaged at the state level. We're currently in 29 states, have over 800 young elected officials who are part of this. And they're not just meeting, but now passing legislation on things from gerrymandering to climate change and veterans employment. And it's about getting these things done.
So how you guys break it down? Because one of the things, that is a driver at some point, regardless of how much I like you or how much I don't like you or what you're doing or what I think you're going to do or not do, there are issues that sort of animate the populace out there. So you're getting these folks who are coming to the table. They've gotten elected to Congress. They come in the door, which is an overwhelming process and moment in and of itself. Good thing you now have this caucus there sort of as a port in the storm, if you will, for them to sort of get their bearings and orientation. But how does MAP work with them in terms of issues and things like that? I mean, I'm thinking of Ocasio-Cortez, mm-hmm. for example, and how she's pulling at least the Democratic caucus in a particular way. But then you have, some of the younger members who maybe at one point or maybe still are part of the Freedom Caucus who are pulling in another way. How do you look to reconcile that, or do you just let the kids play on the playground the way they need to play, but this space that's created for the young members of Congress to come into is hopefully a space where they can sort of overcome some of the partisan noise mm-hmm. to sort of get, someone behind the Green New Deal or behind tax cuts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good metaphor. We let the kids play in the playground, but we want them to be also the adults in the room,
right?
Which is to model civil discourse, to respect people for different political views, and to try and find the best ideas, regardless of where they come from on the political spectrum. And we had a meeting with our new set of co-chairs we'll be announcing in the next few weeks, just recently. And one of the important points raised was just the fact that when you actually get people in a room together, there's so much more that they agree on than they actually disagree on. But you don't see that in the larger public debate. But when you invite that conversation, when you talk about an issue like climate change, they do want to find a bipartisan solution. They want to invest in research and development and get clean energy innovation investments going. They want to, in fact, we have some Republicans who are interested in exploring how do you put some form of a price on carbon and return the revenue back to taxpayers. So they're trying to find an intermediate kind of bipartisan approach that can actually pass. And I think one of the larger dynamics here is if you've been elected at a young age, you want to get something done. You are almost by definition impatient. And I think in our current system, you need to build bipartisan support if you're going to pass something. So it's trying to create that dialogue and for them to model this higher level of discourse, and then hopefully that continues throughout their public service.
Well, that's the thing that's kind of tickles me a bit is the point you made just now about getting something done. And a lot of that, I think, you know, having been in this soup for a long time, and having worked on the Hill for a period of my life as well, is that challenge is getting something done. And one of the things that I took particular note of with the current team of young leaders that are coming, not all of them, because what's happened is some have outsized personalities and a mm-hmm. lot of what they're saying and doing is getting projected on everybody else.
Right.
And that may or may not be, in most cases it is not, where those individuals are coming from because of their own personal stories, the districts they represent, etc. So this idea of getting something done is something that seems to be lost on a few of them.
because
no matter how much you rail against the system, you still need votes.
That's right.
And so it's interesting for me to see how what your members are able to do and how they're able to do it to pull mm-hmm. back away from the electric fences. Those mm-hmm. who seem to be running headlong into that space, and that doesn't end well. And there's a whole lot of noise and screaming,
mm-hmm.
but there's no legislation. So that still remains a core point, no matter what you think about the Congress, for example. That still remains a core requirement for the job. Is you got to get something passed, and the way you do that is to build support for the legislation. Move it along and ultimately mm-hmm. Count those votes that you need. And if you're telling members, if you don't stand with me on X, Y, and Z, I'm coming after you. That's not how you win friends and influence people. Are you running into that? Do you see that? How does that play out with some of the members of the MAP caucus, if you will?
Yeah, well, first, I think you make a good point that there is a lot of noise and some people have the outsized personalities. One, to help reconcile the narrative from the reality, is that most of the millennials who just got elected, which is, by the way, a historic number, 32 were just elected, and most of them ran on a platform of working across the aisle to fix Washington. And a lot of people don't know that because the narrative has been hijacked primarily by AOC, but also, you know, a few of the other members,
right.
I think, you're referencing. And so that becomes a challenge because, unfortunately, the most divisive rhetoric often gets the most media attention.
Sure.
But I think
it leaves
the
blood on the floor.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Someone told me if it bleeds, it leaves, right?
Right, exactly.
and so, you know, how do you deal with that? And the second point you're making about getting something done, building a coalition and pushing a piece of legislation. I don't know about you, but that's my definition of leadership. I think leadership in a democracy means you are building coalitions across faction. You know, Madison in the Federalist Papers, he talked about the violence of faction and that we would need institutions and leaders who can transcend faction. And if you don't do that, then we fall into a lot of dangerous anti-democratic type behavior that, unfortunately, you know, we're seeing today. So I believe, you know, sometimes we see this type of political bridge building is cast in a soft light. And I have the opposite opinion. I believe being a bridge builder in politics while maintaining your imagination and vision is the strongest expression of democracy we have right now. And in fact, it's easy and weak, in my opinion, just to appeal to your own base or your own tribe.
What's your assessment of the millennial generation that is now emerging into leadership full-throatedly and mm-hmm. the generation behind them? What did they call them? The X some
Gen Z.
Gen V. XY. Yeah. Z. Isn't it Z?
Z. Yeah. Gen V.
Gen Z. XYZ. I don't know what comes after them because Z is the last letter last time I checked. But that's a whole nother conversation. But so what's your assessment of them as a whole, particularly when you're looking at the way politics is moving? Donald Trump is outsized personalities, larger than life. His imprimatur is almost indelible at this point. Some will argue for good, others will argue for bad. However you come down on that, this generation and the future generation that's going to be emerging into that, you know, the Parkland students who are graduating this year and are now stepping into space, you know, and the 16 and 17 year olds behind them. What's your assessment overall of their ability to come in and change this system in a way, whether it's the Congress, which is certainly a tall order, but as we've seen in Florida with the Parkland students, the changing of laws at the state legislative level, the gun laws there. How do you assess all of that?
I see a very disruptive generation coming up right now, and I think it will be mostly, I'm hopeful it's mostly positive, but it will be disruptive. And there are a couple very interesting trends. One is with the millennial generation and now extended into Generation Z, is they are the most politically independent generation in America.
Yeah.
Party affiliation is declining. The identification as an independent is increasing. And I actually think a lot of the polling that just kind of writes off millennials as being all socialists actually misses some of the deeper stories underway here. Because just as a quick example, you're calling millennial socialists who are the most skeptical of large institutions, including the federal government.
Right.
So how do you square that?
Right.
And so... And a good example, I'm glad you raised the Parkland students, and we've had the chance to work with them a bit. They are refusing to be boxed in as Democrats or Republicans. Remember when they came to D.C. for this march last year, they were asked by every media outlet, which party are you supporting? Which candidates are you endorsing? They said, no, we don't do that. We're playing a totally different game here. And it's interesting that a few of them, like David Hogg and Cameron Caskey, have talked about being advocates for a more civil dialogue. They want to hear from different viewpoints. So I think those trends are very, very promising.
But isn't the challenge, though? I mean, that's good. And I applaud that. And I love that idealism. But let's smack it up against the harsh reality of the political system itself, which is an entrenched right, left, red, blue, RD environment. What are the prospects then for these new leaders starting in the House? How many you said? 30 some in the House, many of whom probably are women. Number, which I think is probably the definitional point here at the end, but just to finish the thought, how does that all square up against the reality that the political system is entrenched the way it is? And at some point you fall into the red, blue RD trap. Because you want to get reelected. You want to move up the leadership ladder, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, do you see in this generation sort of like, F that, I don't care about that, and are willing to sort of do what I think leaders, a true stripe of a leader, is willing to lose an election, lose pole position, lose the power of you know, popularity, if you will, for the principle of doing the right thing?
I think it's super fascinating. First, we're seeing this new crop of leaders coming in, seeing their role in elected office totally differently. That is, it used to be the case that you want to make a career out of being a politician. This new generation sees it as a gig, much more so than prior generations that I've worked with.
Yeah.
And so there's a that's why you see bipartisan support for term limits. Two members of our caucus, Mike Gallagher and Ro Khanna, two very ideologically disparate members, have been leading the charge on term limits because they believe you should go into office, make a difference, and then leave into the private sector and do something else. And so I think that invites a courageous mentality of, I'm here to try some things that may or may not be popular, and if I lose my election because of it, then so be it. I didn't hinge my entire life on being in elected office. But I do think once they come in, and I agree with you, Michael, about the stark reality. If we live in a red-blue two-party system, they often are faced with this choice of how much do I toe the party line and just play the game versus how much do I shake things up and try and be a disruptor. And everyone I've worked with in Congress falls somewhere on that spectrum. Some more so than others. So if you consider like Seth Moulton, for example, he wanted to be a disruptor and he obviously lost the whole situation with Nancy Pelosi and the speakership. And so there are consequences for that, very real consequences for trying to kind of shake things up. Tulsi Gabbard is another example of someone like that, who I think they believe that, look, if I'm not trying to do things the way that I believe is right, and you can disagree with them or agree with them if you want to, then it's not worth being here in the first place.
I think that's right. And I like that attitude. My concern is the longevity of it. And I've seen so many come in over the years with the fire in their belly, as they say, and the passion in their eyes and the rhetoric on their tongue. And within two terms, you know, they're standing behind the leaders looking like, you know, someone stuck a pole up their ass, and they're with this tight grin on their face. And, you know, because somewhere along the line, they decided they wanted to be in leadership. And, well, this is how you play the game. And all of that, you know, piss and vinegar has gone out the window. And we are where we figured we would be, as they say.
That happens. And I think that's where it's interesting with some, I've noticed with some of the members as they get into their third or fourth terms, that initial idealism does often start to fade a little bit. I think part of our role with Millennial Action Project is to help them in those first few years, that critical moment where they're really deciding what type of representative they want to be. I mean, the thing we want to avoid here is a representative serves for 30 years and then they retire and then they see the light and they want to be a bipartisan statesman. You've seen this. It happens all the time.
I just had that conversation 2 weeks ago with a
Did you really?
With a member who's like, yeah, I'm looking to get out. And I think, you know, we really need to build a better bipartisan. I'm like, shut the fuck up. Shut up. Hey, you've been in this damn joint for 38 years. I don't want to hear this crap, you know.
I
now you want to be bipartisan on the way out the door.
Yeah, it's too late. We got to flip that on its head. But I was talking with a very prominent former senator who served in leadership who told me, love what you're doing, Stephen, because I'll tell you what, when I was rising through the ranks, I was as partisan as they came. And now I'm Mr. Bipartisan. So we need to transform that paradigm. We need there to be better incentives for bipartisan action at the beginning and for that to have some level of currency. And obviously that's not totally there today. And, you know, I always tell my team, we are in this fight primarily because it's hard. If it were easy, we'd probably be doing something else.
That's true. that's very true. And certainly given the variable that you have to deal with, meaning human beings, on any given day, you don't know how that necessarily is going to play out. And speaking of having to deal with human beings, you've got, and I'd be curious to see how you think the Mueller report is playing or will play with folks when it finally hits the street. A lot of the millennial officials have been, to the extent that some have been outspoken or outspeaking on it, they have been, struck, I think, the right tone. Let's see what it is before we get into the nut, you know, nitty gritty of what it is and what it isn't. Certainly, the issue of impeachment is one that a lot of them seem to have bought Nancy Pelosi's pitch that, you know, we're not going to dance on that pinhead again. Wait, let's see what it is. How do you think all this plays out ultimately with this new crop of leaders, or is playing out?
So I think there are two key dynamics here. One deals with the noise, and the second deals with trust. You know, with the noise here, I think there has been so much overconsumption of the Mueller report over the past, in terms of the reporting around the speculation of the Mueller report over the past, you know, 2 years or right. So. And as a result, I think a lot of the representatives and their voters are in many ways, you know, they know their constituents are not so crazed by the Mueller report as often the kind of the DC bubble is. That's one thing I hear all the time from elected officials is, you know, at the ground level, they're talking about healthcare and, you know, jobs. And then all of a sudden at MSNBC, they hear about the Mueller report. So I think being able to break through that noise on what are the actual consequential takeaways from the report is super important. And so far, I think we've seen, at least among the younger representatives, pretty good, as you mentioned, Michael, pretty kind of thoughtful and sober reaction to it. Of course, there's some exceptions.
Yeah.
I think the second issue is dealing with trust here, because I believe it was a huge victory for the country that the Mueller report was able to complete itself and be generally seen as kind of a rigorous study and, you know, as in this environment, as nonpartisan as it could possibly be. Of course, Trump tried to dog it as much as he could.
Right.
But I think, you know, I often reflect on, you know, what George Washington talked about in his farewell address. And he said, you know, when you have extreme partisanship, you open the door to authoritarianism and foreign corruption and influence.
Hello.
And for us, yeah.
That sounds vaguely familiar.
It was a very good prediction. You know, that was a smart, smart prediction. And, you know, you think about how relevant that is today. And here's the thing. I often see where we are right now is if you envision a bowling alley, and, you know, when you grew up, you playing with those bumpers on the left and the right side. So you can move to the left, you can move to the right, but you can't go into the gutter. I think the completion of this Mueller report and just from a trust factor, it just demonstrates that we do still have some guardrails on American democracy that are still in place. Yeah. And so I'm just hopeful that people actually take the time to read it, have a sober conclusion. And if there are true violations of the law, or obviously if there's some real proof of obstruction of justice, then there needs to be some kind of action taken and be willing to accept the truth if those charges are not made. It just seems that this is a it seems based on everything I've seen that the report was well put together and Mueller has tremendous integrity. And that's a good thing that we have someone like that in this country.
Have you guys counseled any of your members on this issue at all? Have they come to you to MAP and said, you know, hey, what, you know, what's the sweet spot here? Or is that, does MAP kind of pretty much stay a little bit away, sort of the Heisman kind of position when it comes to some of these types of issues?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, and informally we've talked to some, you know, members and their teams. But I think more importantly, there's a certain ethos that we've been building for the past 5 years, an ethos around the truth, being data driven, being pragmatic and being forward looking, not getting so tied up in the short term partisan gain or the short term noise and tribalism, but what's important for the long term health of this country. And so to the extent we've been building that ethos, it very much applies to the Mueller report, which is what's important for the long term health of our democracy here. If there's some action that needs to be taken, then do it. but let's make sure we're not tearing us apart at the seams here, because that then invites even worse, I think, examples of collusion potentially in the future, per what George Washington warned us of. So, you know, I think what's more important right now is what's the culture, what are the norms, what are the behaviors that we're building, so when these types of big ticket issues like the Mueller report is in front of our leaders, how do they respond in a sensible, constructive way? And then how do you importantly get some amplification for those sensible approaches, which, as you know, is very difficult.
Right, right. So how do you guys, I mean, how many Republicans slash conservatives are part of the MAP enterprise? And have you gotten any feedback, I put that in quotation marks, from them on the lines of, you know, Mueller or, you know, the president, et cetera, et cetera? Or are these typically more center-right as opposed to hard-right individuals?
They tend to, you know, well, first in terms of numbers, there are about 15 Republicans in Congress we work closely with. Mm-hmm. And at the state level, there are probably about 400
that we work with.
Yeah. Yeah, 400 state legislators. The total network is 800. And so it's about evenly split D's and R's. And we're in both the red states and blue states. We're everywhere from California to Alabama and everything in between. And so I think
I guess
from,
Roy Moore wouldn't be one of your candidates, would you?
No, he didn't reach out to us. You know, we never heard from him.
Yes, I've got a little devil in me. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
Yeah. And actually, what's really cool at the state level is every year we get to bring our members together from across the country, and just hearing the different accents and the different perspectives.
Sure.
And it is so cool, honestly. Like, I wish everyone could be in the room just to see, you know, what that looks like.
Right.
And, you know, we'll have someone from the inner city Detroit sitting next to someone from rural North Carolina. And here's what's powerful, Michael, is when they find that one area of commonality. Okay, they were both Green Berets, and all of a sudden they have this connection that no one would have thought. And then they're able to talk about policy together and have a more good exchange of ideas.
It changes the way people react with each other. If they if they lower their guard and they're not so defensive by presuming this person is an ass or this person's an idiot because they have a D behind their name or an R behind their name, but rather, I mean, I went through this. I'm a Rodell Fellow. Fellow with was formed back in 2005 out of the Aspen Institute, and Mickey Edwards, who was sort of the founding heartbeat of this effort, really focused on bringing together. So I'm really impressed by what you're doing, Steve, is bringing together these elected officials, currently elected, some former elected officials, into a space where they kind of, you know, like you said, have that moment where you hear the different accents, et cetera. And I remember our first meeting, all the Republicans hung together, all the Democrats hung together, and never the twain shall meet. You know, it just kind of looks suspiciously at each other from across the room. But we were in this program for the next few years, so you got to work it out. And it's a lot like coming to Congress. You're in this program, if you will, for the next at least 2 years, and you got to work it out. So I can imagine that moment, you know, for those state legislators, for the members of Congress, to have their eyes and ears open to the rest of the country. Then to find when they do that, damn, this person who is this, you know, this flaming, you know, snowflake liberal was a Green Beret. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that means he's got a little edge to him. All right. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
All of a sudden it changes the whole narrative.
Absolutely. And to your earlier question, Michael, where do they fit on the ideological spectrum? Of course, we have a lot of, among the Republican crew, we certainly have a lot of center-right, but we have a lot of libertarians. We have some true religious conservatives. I'll never forget, actually, at our last summit, we have someone who I think really embodies the kind of evangelical Christian Republican identity. And he's talking with us about mental health issues and a new solution that he put in place in his state. And he's talking about, hey, I'm your like stereotypical Republican, but I really believe we need government-run call centers to make sure that we have licensed clinical professionals receiving calls from people who have real challenges related to mental health, and they can make a big difference. And so I think that sends a powerful message that cooperation is not reserved for the moderate middle. I think we need to bring people from the progressive wing and from the Tea Party wing and from the libertarian wing, all of these different aspects of the spectrum are invited to the table, because right. that's how a healthy democracy works. In fact, I think our movement undermines itself when we only sometimes limit ourselves to the so-called political center. So I get actually most fired up when I see someone who is as far right as you can possibly imagine, who wants to talk about political reform and modernizing the voting system. And when you see cases like that, you're thinking, oh my God,
right.
Like at the national level, no one knows that you exist, like that you, and I would talk with, you know, the state legislator from Georgia who believes in this, and he's making a coherent conservative case for voting reforms. And I'm thinking, this is amazing.
Right.
This is exactly what we need more of.
But the problem he or she will have, and it's true on the left and the right, so on the progressive left and the hard right, is if you start to go down that road, your battle becomes not so much, you know, with your political opponent, the mm-hmm. Democrat standing opposite you, but within your own caucus, within your own party, when you start espousing these either crazy lefty kind of ideas about, you know, education reform or healthcare reform, you know, if you support the idea of someone bringing, you know, bringing into the state, you know, Medicaid, you know, and Medicare kinds of reforms that, you know, we've been talking about the last few years, or on the left, you know, making the case for smaller government and, you know, streamlining this, or, you know, cutting taxes over here or supporting business mm-hmm. over there. They get the crap beat out of them within their own house. So how do you navigate that space for these young leaders, which I think ultimately, because of the beating from within the house, mm-hmm. going back to the point I made earlier, you later on see them standing behind the leadership like a stick up their hands because the fight, they're just like, I just can't take the hits anymore. So, you know, just take the stick and ram it and just move on, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I think, by the way, that's a good rule. Once you've got the stick, it's time to leave.
Yeah.
It's time to leave.
I think it's time to go. I agree. At that point, it's no longer, unless you stood there with a stick, but it's not pleasant, I'm sure.
it's not, no. And you wonder, why are you there in the first place?
Right.
But you're totally right. You get pushed back in your own caucus, and how do you deal with that? I think it ultimately comes down to two really big things, and this is what we emphasize with our members. One is the power of communication, and to the power of relationships. And so last year at our summit, we had someone, you know, Matthew Dowd, who came down and talked about how you navigate a very polarized world when you're working on these issues and taking on positions outside of your party's orthodoxy. How do you deal with that? How do you communicate with it? And as an example, a key thing is to appeal to core values that people have. And so much of this, as you know better than most people, is a lot in how you frame it and mm-hmm. what values are you appealing to.
Right.
You know, for example, you could make a conservative argument for something like Medicare for All.
Absolutely.
In fact, I have a friend who from the Heritage Foundation who made a very coherent conservative argument for Medicare for All. He talks about Medicare Advantage. And so the point is, well, communication is powerful.
You can make a conservative argument for Obamacare, since Obamacare was the Heritage conservative response to Hillary Care.
Exactly.
From 1993.
Exactly.
So, yeah. Clearly, you can do that.
And here's the question then. do leaders have a vocabulary, a set of experiences, and level of insight and even emotional intelligence to understand where different people are coming from? And that's one of the big questions, because what I often see is for people who are currently in their prime, getting elected a governor, and you can even kind of apply this to President Obama in some ways, is they come in with a very genuine desire to be a bridge builder and a consensus builder. And it doesn't translate, because at that point it's too late, right, to be developing all years and years of knowledge of how different people communicate. So I think that's very important. And the second piece that you need to be building over the course of years and years are relationships. And of course, the two are interrelated. If you've built strong relationships with people of these different political backgrounds, you not only have a friendship that transcends politics and transcends so many things. Think about, you know, all the ways that John McCain worked with Ted Kennedy in ways that transcended politics.
Right.
That not only gives you governing partners, hence an ability to move things forward, but also it teaches you something about the background they come from and the language that's being used and what the values are. And so I think that's what we need to be building in this new generation of leaders. It's not enough just to say you want to be a consensus builder. How have you been preparing yourself to be a credible consensus builder when your time comes?
So I got a couple of things more I want to hit you on it. And one of them has to do, how do you assess the millennial presidential field from Buttigieg to Beto? How does that narrative play itself out? Some pushback is, okay, yeah, they're like way too young to be doing this. They need to have more. I mean, you're the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, for goodness sakes. I mean, it's 100,000 people, really. And of course, you know, with Beto, you get you ran against Ted Cruz. If you'd run against Joe Smith, you wouldn't have raised the money, and B, no one would have cared about the election. So you have the cynics that sort of eat at these millennial candidates, but they are finding their way to cut through. And a lot of it, I think, has to go to what you've already said in terms of how this generation is approaching politics. What's your initial take on the landscape as we see these 30-something and 40-something-year-olds begin to say, we're not going to wait until we're 60 to run for president. We're doing it now.
Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting. First, it's important to just take stock of this moment, that for all the talk we've had about millennials over the past few years, we now have credible millennial presidential candidates. And what does that mean in terms of the issue agenda and in terms of the practice of doing politics? It's very different in many ways. I think one of the things that's now cutting through with the younger candidates, and in addition to Mayor Pete and Beto, who runs like he's a millennial, he's actually older than people realize.
And he is. You know? He is a lot older. Right? He does run like he's a millennial. Because he's got that young look about him, too. So
he does. He certainly does. Everyone is shocked when I tell them that Beto is basically the same age as Ted Cruz.
Right.
Because, you know, Beto ran as a 46-year-old, really, who's running as like a 26-year-old. And I would say Ted Cruz was 40-something running as a 70. Yeah, exactly. But you also have now Eric Swalwell, congressman from California, who just recently announced, and you have Tulsi Gabbard as well. Perhaps there are others who jump in. And just taking stock of that moment is important. The second thing is, I believe the authenticity is really cutting through with some of these candidates, particularly Beto and Mayor Pete, because one thing our generation is very good at is having a strong BS radar. And I think people are so tired of like politician BS, and right, they're looking for an authentic, sincere way of cutting through. And so we're starting to see that now with these younger candidates. The third thing that I think is super important is that, and this is important for the entire country, before those candidates announced, we were getting into, I think, a very dangerous place that was a false choice between old establishment moderate and then dynamic, diverse bomb thrower, flamethrower on the extreme. And so I'm thinking to myself, really, in our country, if you want to be someone who's governing and leading and trying to build coalitions, there is this assumption, an immediate kind of linkage with being old establishment and just kind of out of touch a little bit and lacking imagination. And then it's think of like you've got Biden and AOC, and we're like trying to choose between those two. So to have two candidates now, like Beto and Mayor Pete in particular, who are trying to take a different approach. Beto in particular, his whole premise is trying to be a healer.
Right.
He says, I don't care who you voted for before. I don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican. We're human beings and we're Americans. I think it's just useful, just from a political image and political archetype standpoint, to have someone who's young, dynamic, and talking about bridge building. I think Mayor Pete is doing a lot of the same, and it's interesting. He's having a number of Republicans and conservatives publicly express their interest, if not being impressed with his candidacy so far.
Yeah, I'm impressed. I'm impressed with him. I think he's a very impressive guy, he does bring that to the table. But this is, you know, April of 2019. So
it is, yeah.
Talk to me in July of 2020, and then and we'll see.
Yeah, well, you'll remember, I'm sure, very clearly that 2012. You had the flavor of the month, right?
Yep.
Herman Cain and everyone else.
999.
Exactly. So we've yet to see if this is a flavor of the month kind of situation, or if some of these candidates have real staying power. And I think the good news is at least they're getting attention, and now it's on them to really perform. And I think with Mayor Pete so far, he seems to be doing everything right. But, let's see where we are 6 to 8 months from now.
He's starting to get a little bit of the heckling challenge, which is always I think that always that's going to play to his strength, though. I mean,
So
people heckling him about his lifestyle, quote, and his, marriage and et cetera, and being a gay man, citing Sodom and Gomorrah it's like, okay, really? So you think now you're going to persuade people to turn against him because you stand there looking like an idiot saying what you're saying. Okay. But I digress.
I think in terms, just real quick point on that, I think his identity is partly what helps him transcend a number of the factions in the Democratic Party
now. Sure.
When you talk to establishment types who are in the think tank community and then movement people at the grassroots, he is transcending all of those different factions, and his smarts, intelligence, and all of those things help him do that. Being a mayor, as someone who solves problems, is helpful, but also his, let's not kid ourselves. The identity has a role as well. And it's doing something that Barack Obama was able to do in 2008 when, he tried to bring these different factions of the party together. It's very interesting to watch.
It is. And the question is, will the Democrats nominate a 37-year-old gay man to become president? And will the country elect a 37-year-old gay man as president? And that is, at the end of the day, Mayor Pete moves from obscurity to third place on the current rung of the ladder, something that will get defined not just by him, but by the American people ultimately, as they kind of assess, to your point about Barack Obama, as they did in 2008, they assess where they want the future of the country to go. And what political statement they want to make in the moment about their willingness to make change and to make change happen. And some will say from Obama to Trump was a retreat. away from change because they were like, oh my God, hair on fire. No, this is not what we bargained for. Although in the main, Obama really wasn't that scary. He didn't, you know, you look at a lot of proposals, you could disagree with it, but it wasn't where we see ourselves now, where it's disrupting legal institutions, security institutions, you know, relationships abroad, and of course, fermenting racial animosity here at home. And that's all happened in the last 24 months. So, so the question then becomes from Trump to more Trump or Trump to something else will be an interesting question to answer for the voters as they look at individuals like Beto, Pete, Kamala, and maybe even someone who emerges on the Republican side. So before I let you go, I wanted to get your thoughts on the tragedy in Paris, the burning of the Notre Dame, which was just heartbreaking to watch. And the reason I'm curious about, I mean, aside from the obvious reaction to seeing an 80-year-old structure that is replete with history, et cetera. What I took note of, and I was curious about how you look at it, given the work you're doing and the individuals you work with, was the reaction by the younger generation, millennials, watching pictures of them gathered I'll use the word mourn in some sense, standing, you know, singing songs, recognizing the importance of this. Because a lot of people, and you touched on this a little bit earlier in our conversation, a lot of people look at millennials and think that they are, you know, sort of the self-centered, egomaniacal, egotistical kind of, you know, it's all about me generation, which is not true. But people have that perception, you know, and you hear some of the crazy stories. But in this moment, it struck me both in Paris as well as here in the U.S., the reaction on Twitter, for example, by young people, to me, was very heartening, I thought, that to sort of work against that stereotype. What was your sense of what you saw from that moment and how it reached into your generation?
Well, I think, to your point, the reaction was really powerful to see. And in this very fragmented world that we live in today, to have this one moment that did actually seem to cut across and cut through was quite remarkable. And I think you're right that moments like these actually it changed our perceptions at sometimes what this younger generation really is about. And every time people talk about the self-centered, self-indulgent generation, I just remind people that today millennials have the highest levels of service participation rates in the country. Like, they're volunteering more, getting engaged in their community, you know, more than anyone else.
Right.
And and you look at other studies that show that this younger generation, more than anything, when they're looking for a career, is what kind of impact can they have on their larger community. And so, you know, there are these different narratives out there, but I think the reaction that we saw to Notre Dame, and by the way, I've been there a couple times. It's a special place.
It really
gets to you.
Yeah.
You know, and it's great to see that we can still have some, you know, unifying moments and moments where we can all take a moment and pause, you know, when otherwise I think we're all like hamsters, just like kind of running and running and running, and you know, all in our different directions. And there's a moment we can just stand and kind of look at each other and reflect on what we care about, from a faith perspective and from a human perspective. It's powerful.
It is, and I was also really moved and struck by you know, the call and the support by these young Parisians, and in particular, to rebuild. So, you know, because again, this sort of detachment from history, detachment from things that have been associated with the old institutions, if you will, is where I think a lot of people would believe they would come down. But they sort of got what Notre Dame represented and represents to Parisians, but to the world. And they, and their appreciation of that, I think, was it was really heartening to see in some sense. So I think the future is in good hands. I'm not concerned about that at all. As some seem to be, as these various narratives unfold both here at home and abroad. Steve Olakara, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate you taking some time out to sort of help us contextualize not just the work you're doing at the Millennial Action Project, but how millennials are already making and having such an important impact on our nation's politics, culture, and what that means for the future. And as I just said, I think we have a lot to look forward to.
Well, I appreciate that. Always a pleasure to talk with you. And thank you for all you're doing to shine a spotlight, you know, on efforts that are positive and regenerative in our democracy. We need more conversation about it. And I know it's something you care a lot about. So I'm very grateful and honored to be part of your show.
I appreciate that. And I appreciate you being at the tip of the spear and sort of helping to lay some course and direction for that very conversation. So I appreciate you taking time and look forward to having you back as we get into the campaign season, as you know, things really begin to take shape and evolve, and to see the role and impact your members who are part of the Millennial Action Project are doing, and how they're moving the needle, as they say.
Absolutely. That'd be great.
All right, folks. Well, that does it for this time. I'm so glad you took the time to chat with us and listen with us. But before I go, just want to just raise one little thing with you. You know what happens to most of us at some point or another? Debt just sort of creeps up on you. You know how that is? How many of us have looked at our finances and screamed, "How can we make this much and still have so much debt?" Unexpected repairs, replacing the washer and dryer, medical bills, and of course the killer, those insane interest credit cards you had to use to pay for it all, right? Here's a really smart move that could help you get on top of your finances. Get a fixed rate personal loan at bestegg.com. The rates are great right now. And now imagine finally being able to pay down those crazy high credit cards and bills, and then bank the money you save each month. Consumers have rated Best Egg 4.8 out of 5 stars on Consumer Affairs because of the super easy online app that takes about a minute with no impact to your credit score. Upon approval, funds can be deposited in as little as one business day. So get your bills under control. Bank what you save and take control of your finances with a loan from bestegg.com. Visit bestegg.com/plan. That's bestegg.com/plan. Don't forget, go to Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you get your podcasts on. Do that download thing. We love it when you do. Also follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. This is the Michael Steele Podcast. Catch you next time.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar. With a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry, IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.